The Exchange Daily Podcast is brought to you by
Doucette Survey, serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England, now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine. Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, equal housing opportunity.
Enjoy the show.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. A small community college got a big shout out recently. The New Hampshire Technical Institute in Concord was ranked as number one in the nation for value added. That's the measure the DC-based Brookings Institution came up with as a way to assess thousands of 2- and 4-year schools based on what additional economic benefit students received from attending that particular college or university. Later in our hour today, we'll talk with one of the report's lead authors. But first, healthcare providers, business leaders, low-income Granite Staters all made a similar pitch to New Hampshire state senators on Tuesday. Please continue with Medicaid expansion. The House version of the state budget did not include funding for the plan, called the New Hampshire Health Protection Program. The plan appears to have more support in the Senate. Today in The Exchange, we look once again at this issue and the arguments around it. And let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We have two guests for this topic. Charlie Arlinghouse is here, president of the Josiah Bartlett Center, a free market think tank in Concord. And Charlie, nice to see you. Thanks for being here.
It's great to be here.
Also with us, Tom Bunnell, policy consultant for New Hampshire Voices for Health. And Tom, thanks for taking time out.
It's good to be with you, Laura.
Well, Charlie, just clarify for us first, please, because we're going to talk a lot about traditional Medicaid and the Medicaid expansion. What's traditional Medicaid? Who's eligible? Who pays for it?
Traditional Medicaid, we think of Medicaid as the program that is essentially healthcare for poor people. But it's not really. It's old-fashioned Medicaid or traditional Medicaid is essentially a program with categorical eligibility. People are eligible because they fit into a certain category of eligibility. Children is the largest one, for example. There's some categories of disability, a small group of people with breast cancer, for example. And they're below certain income levels. Those income levels tend to differ between certain people. Medicaid expansion was designed under the Federal Affordable Care Act to fill in what you might think of as a hole. There are categories of low-income people who were not eligible for any kind of Medicaid, and they wanted to expand to them. That tends to be, largely speaking, single childless adults.
So under current Medicaid or traditional Medicaid, you have to be poor and
something, yes.
Pregnant, elderly, a child, have a disability, and so forth. It doesn't go for people who are just poor.
Yeah, just poor. There's some categories of parents, but otherwise, no.
What's the philosophy around that, Charlie?
Well, the philosophy, like many of our, let's call them welfare programs or social insurance programs, are designed to help certain categories of people. Well, most of them don't actually help single childless adults. It's designed to provide some sort of a social safety net for people. The thought was with most of them, people who aren't working or who for some other reason can't take care of themselves.
Okay, so Tom, what's the philosophy behind expanding Medicaid to this new group of folk, single childless adults? Not disabled, not elderly, not struggling with some extra condition.
Well, again, I would just add to what my friend Charlie said and said that these are lower income folks below a certain income level, and it doesn't matter whether they are parents or whether they are single, they are covered. So, in fact, there are parents who are included in this sort of category. But the idea is that there are, especially in New Hampshire, where we have such a prevalence of small businesses, there are businesses that are unable to offer coverage to their employees, And there are lower-income employees who may be unable to afford whatever coverage may be offered. So the philosophy was to be able to provide an opportunity for lower-income people to have health coverage and really to provide them with both health security and peace of mind that comes with health coverage.
And we also often hear, Tom, that this new Medicaid expansion covers folks up to 138% of poverty.
That's correct.
What does that mean in terms of dollars?
It's about $16,000 for an individual, and it's about $33,000 for a family of four.
And, you know, Tom, I'm sure you've heard people say this, that this coverage is going to healthy adults of working age, so not senior citizens, not children, and that these folks could get a job with health coverage. This program has been called a disincentive to work. What do you think?
Well, I think the data shows that there are many, many companies that just don't and can't afford to offer private health coverage to their employees. And as a result of that, we've had a large number of uninsured, lower income people in New Hampshire who struggle. And again, who's because of their income levels traditionally have, when they have sought care, sought it in a context that is uncompensated care. Which creates medical debt for them and also creates obligation by healthcare providers.
Sure, and that's the macroeconomics that we'll definitely look at that. Yeah, the idea that this creates a burden of uncompensated care. The hospitals have talked a lot about that. But on this idea, Charlie, of, okay, let's say you don't qualify for traditional Medicaid because you're a single childless adult. You're working, but your job doesn't provide health insurance. What other options do you have?
Well, with any sort of a social welfare program, a social safety net program, if you will, there are always these trade-offs. And you know, we think of somebody who is quite poor and has no health insurance whatsoever. But we also think of the question is, you do want to create a program that does not create disincentives in them. And there's no way to
disincentives to work.
Disincentives to work. Disincentives for other things as well. Disincentives for people to offer health care. Whatever it is with whatever program. The disincentive to work, we do know that happens. I mean, the Congressional Budget Office, it's not just people like me, have discussed that. And there are a number of people who will not work. And we've seen it with similar programs like this when they expanded programs to this category of people. Employment went down. And when they canceled programs like this, Tennessee is a notable example, recently, a few years back, employment went up significantly because there are disincentives. That's obviously not everybody in the program. In fact, it's probably less than half the people in the program, might work or otherwise. But that is one of the trade-offs that you make, and it's a question of what you do. Anytime you create a program, there will be some people covered and some people not. And the question is, what happens with some people who are not? Yeah, in New Hampshire, a number of people get uncompensated care or charity care, if you will, through hospitals and other entities and other programs. And, that's going to continue today with the people who aren't in the program. And it would continue if there weren't this program as well.
And as we talk about incentives, I have to ask you this, Tom. What about the idea that Medicaid expansion gives businesses an incentive to not offer their employees health care? They say, great, the federal government's going to take care of it. I don't need to bother.
Well, Laura, I'm happy to address that, but I think it's also easy to talk about the Medicaid expansion population in a really distanced way. And there is a human face to Medicaid expansion. It is hardworking folks who all of us know, who service meals in restaurants and scan our groceries at the store and sweep and vacuum our workplace floors and fix our cars, cut our hair, work in a whole range of shops in our communities. They teach and care for our kids at child care centers. They provide in-home services and to elders and people with disabilities. There are even adults who are going back to school to get a better education. So there's a sort of wide swath of people. And the faces of Medicaid expansion are people that all of us know and care about and interact with on a daily basis in communities across our state. So I want us to be able to sort of keep that in mind.
So as we're talking about the human face and where these folks work, why aren't the auto body shops or the hair salons offering them health insurance so that the government won't have to pick it up?
Because health insurance is extraordinarily expensive. And many, many small businesses cannot afford to offer it. And those small businesses that can afford to offer it can only afford to offer it with cost sharing for the employees that is likely to be unaffordable for an individual that earns only up to $16,000.
What do you think about that, Charlie?
Well, one of the things to keep in mind is a lot of people in this population are not necessarily working full time, and that if you're not working full time, you're less likely to be offered benefits. If you're a part time worker, if you're a secondary worker, that's a simple truism that's part of what's going on here, and that this was designed originally. The idea of expanding this population was designed with a program that included subsidies on exchange for people above certain income levels. Some portion of the Medicaid expansion population is actually eligible for subsidies on the exchange, although they would have to pay a much larger share of their healthcare costs under that sort of subsidy, which is actually some people would argue is a problem with the Medicaid expansion.
So, and we hear a lot, Charlie, in this economy of people who are working part-time, who, as you say, don't get health insurance because they're working part-time, even though their employer may offer it for full-time workers, and they want to be working full-time, but the hours just aren't available. So is that an argument for requiring employers to cover more workers, whether they're working 20 hours, 25 hours, or 40?
I think it's important to understand that anytime if we were to mandate that employers provide health insurance, or that we were mandate that they provide a benefit, what we're mandating is not that they increase people's compensation, but that they redirect the compensation cost into one particular mechanism. Whether an employer provides you health insurance, provides you some other kind of benefit, or provides you a cash payment in terms of, say, a salary or a wage, it's all the same to them. And it's how you receive it. I mean, there are some employers who will say, look, this is how much I'm going to pay you. You decide how you take it. You're going to take it as health insurance. You're going to take it as a salary. It's up to you. And you can do one or the other. And it's important to understand that you're not just adding on to them and saying, yeah, you're just going to add something to them. Well, no, then the employee will get less money. When the employer's health care costs go up, raises go down, and that's just a simple fact of economics.
Do you want to jump in, Tom, and then we're going to take a quick break?
I thought I heard Charlie perhaps advocating for employers to pay their employees more than they do currently, but I may be mistaken.
I'm an advocate of employers paying employees, and it's a decision they have to make economically, and I think it's a decision that you and I would have to. I have no idea how much public radio should pay Laura. But public radio probably has a pretty good idea. I don't want the government to dictate how much she gets paid.
We won't go there right now. But after a short break, we'll talk a lot more. We'll take your phone calls to the exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. More on Medicaid expansion in the Granite State after a short break. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, another look at Medicaid expansion in the Granite State. The idea is once again before the legislature, as the current Medicaid expansion plan is set to sunset in about a year and a half. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. We want your thoughts, comments, questions on New Hampshire Medicaid expansion, also known as the New Hampshire Health Protection Program. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. And gentlemen, let's go to Tasha in Merrimack first. Hi, Tasha. You're on The Exchange. Go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to comment. Thank you, by the way, for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I wanted to comment that this plan has made a great deal of difference positively in my life. I'm a self-employed, full-time, single mom, and I could not afford insurance prior to this plan. I make too much money to qualify for Medicaid, and yet not enough to qualify for subsidies under Obama's care. So it has taken the stress out of my daily work choices. I can take business that I otherwise had to turn away because I was afraid I would get injured. And it's actually helped me to get more business in what I do. So
What did you get? What did you do for care beforehand, Tasha?
Well, I practice pet grooming. I do a holistic pet grooming business out of my home, so I can be a stay-at-home mom. And I had to cut back on taking large dogs because I was concerned about back injury, shoulder injury, because I'm getting older now, and these things are becoming vulnerable. Illness. I mean, I would have to take days off. If I was to sprain my ankle or, you know, the slightest little injury, it probably would bankrupt me.
Okay.
It would put me out of work for a significant amount of time, and I wouldn't be able to make up for the costs.
Tasha, thank you very much for calling in. Good to hear from you. And what an unusual choice of profession. That's fun to hear about. Charlie, what do you think? You hear stories like this. The legislature was full of people like Tasha this week saying, you know, this has really helped me. Please don't take it away. That was the concern when this started, right? That once you jump in, it's hard to jump back out.
Yeah. And there are ways, if the legislature did decide to walk away from the program, one of the things that they're going to, I think, end up debating is if we change the program or walk away from it, how would that transition work? Are there sensible ways to do that other than just canceling the program? I think that's certainly on the table. And people like Tasha make a lot of sense. People should know, she said she made too much to qualify for Medicaid and not enough to qualify for the exchange. We did cover some parents. Unlike the single childless adults where we covered nobody, with some parents there was a gap between the exchange subsidy and what she gets, which is what we're talking about there. The question about what you do and how you structure the program, this has always been part of it. And in designing the program and in deciding whether or not we continue the program and how a continued program might be structured, given the cost, one of the debates has always been about if we're changing Medicaid to a program that covers everybody below a certain income level, regardless of status, as opposed to categorical eligibility, income-based eligibility, how does that affect all the other components of the program? There's some components of the program which cover up to a fairly high level of income. And would you adjust that? Would you instead try to create a Medicaid program? Because I think everybody agrees we should have some sort of a healthcare social safety net, some sort of a social insurance program there. How would you structure that program? And would you try to cover more people like Tasha? And if you're doing that, are you going to tweak the program in other ways? And one of the discussions that I regretted never happened was that sort of discussion.
Well, this gets to something that House Finance Committee Chair Neil Kirk said on the exchange last month, that the House felt that this issue should not be part of the budget. It was too important to be sort of lumped in with all the other budgetary work. Let's hear what Chairman Kirk said.
This is an issue which the legislature needs to decide, but independent of the budget. There will be legislation introduced in the 2016 session that will deal with this, and we will have this debate at that time. But to do it in the budget, it's such an important issue that was an inappropriate place to make this major policy decision.
Again, that's House Finance Committee Chair Neil Kirk talking about partly why the House didn't include Medicaid expansion in the budget. Tom Bunnell, what do you think? Charlie outlined that this is very complicated and maybe we should look at this separately.
Well, I think there were two reasons why Governor Hassan included it in her budget to begin with. One is that we have, as you know, a two-year budget period, and the last 6 months of that two-year budget period go beyond the current date that this program is supposed to sunset. So there was that concern that the budget needed to include this for that two-year period.
And just to make crystal clear for our listeners, this sunsets in 2016. Then the federal government drops its commitment down from 100% to 95%. Therefore, New Hampshire would have to kick in X amount of dollars between January and June of 2017.
That is correct, although I would also in response to that say that there are other concerns that relate to that cost and offsets from that cost. So there is a just published study commissioned by the Robert Johnson Foundation and conducted by Manat Health Services, which is sort of a nationally renowned expert consultants in the healthcare world, also respected by state governments, and focused on eight very diverse states that is called States Expanding Medicaid See Significant Budget Savings and Revenue Gains. So the real issue for the budget is whether there is a net cost to our state, and if so, how much? And thanks in part to a tax paid by insurance companies, the health protection program, our Medicaid expansion, brings in state revenues and generates budget savings over this upcoming two-year period, this budget cycle, that offset those state expenses associated with the program. So while there is, on the one hand, a $12 million state cost for that last six-month period, there also are these revenues associated with the program and savings that in the big budget world offset those costs.
$12 million for the 6 months, and then however much it costs if you renew it for the next 2 years.
Correct.
Yeah.
So because this is in fact a voluntary program, because the Supreme Court and the federal government have been clear that states can get in whenever they want and they can actually get out whenever they want, that this is a decision because of budgetary concerns that makes sense for the legislature to be revisiting with its biennial budget each 2 years. And I will just mention one more thing, and sorry to take so much time, but the other concern about including it in the current budget was that part of our creative bipartisan framework for how this program works is that all of the current enrollees, and there are more than 39,000, almost 40,000 enrollees now since the program started on August 15th of this past year, are currently in Medicaid-managed care, but will be transitioning to coverage, Medicaid finance coverage, on the private insurance marketplace starting January 1st of 2016.
So it's privately-based insurance program coming pretty soon.
And because the health insurance companies that need to put their plans on the marketplace have to accommodate their plans for these folks, there is concern that because of the deadlines for filing their plans with the government come so soon, that in fact, if the decision happens next session, it will be too late for those private insurance companies to make those plans and make those decisions. And so the insurance department—
I see. That's the reason for doing it now with the budget, because
correct.
The private insurers are saying, whoa, 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 we can't wait that long.
The private insurers and the New Hampshire Insurance Department, correct. Yes.
Okay, got another question for you, Tom, but Charlie, go ahead and jump in there.
Well, I was just going to say that you know, and Tom's done a good job of outlining some of the things that people are considering, and there are a bunch of things like this that the legislature is thinking about. How is the program working? What's happening under the current program now? Is the change that might come January 1st going to change that effect? That's probably not going to make a big difference in terms of the efficacy of the program and how we might look at it. There are studies being done on whether or not there are budget savings because of this or not, studies that need to be looked into that are just coming out. There are questions about what the federal government's going to do going forward. Federal government, you know, they're going to ratchet down to 90. The federal government will eventually ratchet down to 95% coverage. Our program was passed on the presumption that we will always get 100% coverage, which is why it sunsets at the end of 2016 when 100% coverage sunsets. If we went down to 95% coverage, if the program were reauthorized and we went down to 95%,
which still
coverage,
sounds like a lot.
Sounds like a lot. The big ballpark numbers, it would cost the state around $50 million and it cost the feds around $450 million. Those are very round numbers based on a whole lot of assumptions, but ballpark for the purpose of debate. There's a lot of talk that the federal government is going to ratchet down. They're not really going to do 95%. A lot of the Republicans in Congress have talked about that's an easy way to save money is to do 85 or 80. The president himself in his 2013 budget talked about a blended rate, which would between double and triple the cost of the state would pay, depending on which state you're in. In our state, it would probably be about double. So there are a whole lot of questions that are going on. To do it in the budget process, it would amount to the equivalent of basically a half-hour debate. Hey, this is a great thing. Let's keep doing it. Or, yeah, I'm not so sure it's a great thing. Let's keep doing it. And I think that people like Neil Kirk, for example, think that it's probably a lot more complicated than that.
So some concern, Charlie, and we've heard this before, that the federal government says it will go down to 95%. And I thought it was 90% at some point, right?
Eventually it'll get down to 90%.
But then the promise is it'll stay there forever, and you're saying maybe yes, maybe no.
Well, it won't. I mean, it's easy for federal governments to balance their budget by not giving the states as much as they said, which they've done in the past with some programs. It's easy for state governments to do the same thing with local because, yeah, I don't know. That's their problem.
Tom, real quick, and then I've got another question for both of you.
was just going to make a quick point that that matching, that federal financing rate is actually built into federal law, federal statute. The only way it could be changed, it can't be changed in a federal budget decision. The only way it can be changed is if Congress passes legislation that the president signs that changes that matching rate. And there's been no indication that that's going to happen, at least in the foreseeable future.
Again, our number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. 1-800-892-6477. For the next couple minutes, we're digging back into the issue of Medicaid expansion here in the Granite State, looking at some of the arguments around this. 1-800-892-6477. And gentlemen, circling back to something that Tom said earlier, and I definitely want to hear you on this, Charlie, as well, the idea that Medicaid expansion, or the hope was that it would save money, lower costs, because healthcare providers would be getting paid for care that they used to give for free, the uncompensated care that we've talked about, where somebody comes into the ER, they're treated no matter what. Here's Medicaid expansion supporter, Republican Senator Jeb Bradley. He was talking on the exchange a couple months ago about the possible savings to the state through Medicaid expansion.
The early results of Medicaid expansion are that ER visits have declined rather dramatically, almost 20%. And this uncompensated care issue, as we get more numbers back, should be going down dramatically, too.
So what do you think, Charlie? Again, we talked earlier about the benefit to the individual from Medicaid expansion, the concerns for the state budget. What are you hearing from providers like hospitals or insurers or businesses about the costs and whether they actually are going down?
Senator Bradley is referring to a study that the New Hampshire Hospital Association did of its members in the first 6 months of the program, where they compared the costs in those 6 months to the analogous 6 months the year before. And they found that the number of uninsured patient visits to emergency rooms was down 17%. They looked at, I think, four different categories of service, and they were down. It's a very preliminary piece of information, and obviously they're very, very happy about it. The hospitals have been the biggest supporters of Medicaid expansion because their thinking is, and this seems to be bearing out, is that people will still come to the hospital for what they came for before, but instead of the hospital giving them charity care because they're uninsured, the hospital will get a Medicaid payment for that person. The hospital study, what it actually found is that the number of patient visits did not decline at all. The number of uninsured patient visits did decline, which means that people aren't actually getting more service, but less of that service is uninsured, which suggests to us very anecdotally, I think, not anecdotally, but I think you can infer from that, that same people are coming, but some of them, fewer of them are uninsured now. They're getting a Medicaid payment.
But do we
know for the hospital, this is a great thing.
Do we know that those newly insured people, if we can call them that, who are coming to the hospital, but now they have insurance, do we know that they got their insurance through Medicaid expansion, which is what we're talking about today? Or did they get it on the private exchanges that the Affordable Care Act sets up?
It's probably a little bit of both. I mean, all we really know is that the same number of people are coming, fewer of them are uninsured. And that the two things that have happened in that time period are that we cover 39,000 people through the Medicaid expansion program, and that some more people are getting insurance through the exchange as well. And so those two things probably combined to do that. Although Senator Bradley's not quite precise in his language in that costs are not necessarily going down, but it is a significant benefit to hospitals and to their cash flow.
Tom, jump in, and then we'll take a call.
I just wanted to add to Charlie's remarks about the hospital study that, in fact, it was focused on people below 130% of poverty. In other words, on the same population that
so
is
they
now.
So they did crunch those numbers?
These numbers apply to that population at the same income level as this program. And so I think there is some direct attribution between the existence of Medicaid expansion and the lowering of uncompensated care costs for providers, in their world.
So as Charlie said, it's great for the providers, helps their cash flow. Is it making the premiums for the rest of us go down? Because that was also supposed to be the hope.
It clearly reduces pressure. And this is in fact why New Hampshire Statewide Chamber of Commerce, the Business and Industries Association supports this health protection program and supports its reauthorization, in part because – and studies have been done to show that uncompensated care leads to what is known as cost shifting, where the costs are ultimately shifted onto the payers of private health insurance premiums, including the business community and all of the rest of us that have that. And as that gets reduced, there is less pressure to increase the cost of private health insurance premiums.
That's the hope. Has it happened?
No, it hasn't happened. The studies do suggest that because hospitals are paying this uncompensated care, those costs are shifted. But the same studies, for example, the Department of Insurance had this in a study they did, our Department of Insurance. When that goes away, we don't really realize the savings the hospitals do. And so it doesn't – that the reverse doesn't necessarily happen and, in fact, is very unlikely to happen. That's not a finding that is universally agreed on one way or the other.
All right. Let's take one more call, gentlemen. This is Elaine in Leominster. Hi, Elaine. Go ahead. You're on The Exchange.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I had a question about the Medicaid expansion. If it should go away and the people on the new Medicaid lose their benefits and all end up back on charity care, myself included, because I am on the New Hampshire Health Protection Program, who ultimately pays for that?
Okay. Elaine, thank you very much for calling in. Real quick, Charlie, you touched on this earlier, but go ahead.
That's sort of what we said, that the charity care, the hospital charity care costs would go up, and that would be affected through uncompensated care payments from the state budget, which are part of this program, and in theory to some cost shifting. It's unlikely that if the program were canceled that everybody would just lose their insurance. There would probably be a transition effect where people would – because people time out of the program because their income level goes up and they move to a different coverage. And what would probably happen is people currently on the program would be grandfathered.
But then beyond that, who knows?
Beyond that, who knows?
Yeah. Real quick, Tom?
I think that's right. Beyond that, who knows?
So, okay, that's something to explore perhaps in another program, the idea of if this goes away, what there might be available for some of the folks like our caller. Elaine, thank you very much for calling in. And Charlie Arlinghouse, Tom Bunnell, good to see you. Thank you for being here. Thank you very much. Really appreciate it. Coming up, just in time for graduation season, New Hampshire Technical Institute, Concord's Community College, gets a huge thumbs up from a prestigious research institution. We'll find out why. That's coming up on The Exchange here on NHPR. This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Laura Kanoy. For the rest of the hour, we turn to higher education and a recent major shout-out for NHTI, New Hampshire Technical Institute, based in Concord, one of the state's community colleges. The Brookings Institution in Washington recently ranked NHTI best in the nation in terms of what it calls value added. With us now is Jonathan Rothwell. He's one of the lead researchers of this study. And Jonathan, thanks for taking time out.
My pleasure.
Well, first off, the obvious question, what's value added, Jonathan?
Well, the idea behind value added is that colleges differ in the types of students that go to their enroll in their school. So if you compare the typical Ivy League student who has aced the SAT or ACT, graduated at the top of his or her class, to the typical community college student, they're very far apart often in terms of their level of academic preparation, family incomes, many cases age and other demographic characteristics. So what we're trying to do with the concept of value added is level the playing field so that schools can be compared based on the sorts of students that go there. And the idea is really to look at things – economic outcomes is what we're focused on. So mid-career salaries, loan repayment rates, and the sorts of occupations that alumni enter, and say how well does the school do in contributing to those outcomes versus how much of it is really the result of very well-prepared students entering those schools.
So trying to add some more depth to this idea that, you know, a young person who enters a prestigious school with all the advantages in the world, money, health, you know, family background, whatever, versus someone who's had a lot of struggles, you're trying to discern how much value each institution adds to that person's experience.
Correct. So current college rankings like U.S. News, Money, Forbes, they reward schools on the ranking system for attracting the most academically accomplished students. And what we're doing is trying to adjust for that and get a sense of how well the school itself is preparing students to succeed after they graduate.
And this is just about economic value, right, Jonathan? This only measures dollars and cents, not whether graduates are happy, satisfied with their work. You know, some people would say, okay, I don't need to make top dollar, but I want to be feeling like I'm making a contribution and happy to get up every day. You didn't measure all that other stuff.
Right. Yeah. Obviously, it raises many philosophical questions. You consider value across a whole range of spectrums, including the things you just mentioned. We focused on economic issues for practical reasons, in part. It's much easier to measure salary with precision than in someone's level of happiness or to what extent they're contributing to the greater good of society or that they're a moral person. But then it's also just well recognized that even people that want to do well in the world, are going to be affected by how much income they make, and you want to know something about where you're going to go to school is going to translate into your financial prospects. And that's especially relevant, I think, for people entering two-year colleges and less selective schools that don't come from the affluent family backgrounds where they would have that financial cushion if they decided to become an artist or something like that.
Again, for the next couple of minutes here in The Exchange, we're talking with Jonathan Rothwell. He's a fellow with the Metropolitan Policy Program at the Brookings Institution in D.C. He co-authored this new report that we're talking about on value-added college rankings. And in just a moment, we'll look at what he found out about NHTI. It's pretty close to the top of the list. 1-800-892-6477 is the number for you to join us with your questions and comments on this idea of value added. How much value added any particular higher education institution might add for an individual. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. One more time, the number 1-800-892-6477. So you ranked colleges this way, and you kind of hinted to this earlier, Jonathan, that because the other rankings weren't really meaningful. Give us a little bit more on that, the typical U.S. News and Forbes rankings and so forth that everybody talks about.
Yeah, so in those rankings, schools like Princeton and Harvard typically come up on top, and it's not that we're saying those are not actually good schools. They're fabulous schools. They score very well, even on our value added measures. Although in many cases they're not the top. So if you just look at value added with respect to mid career salary, we found that the California Institute of Technology was at the top. MIT was up there, but also schools that most people haven't heard of, like Rose Holman Institute of Technology in Indiana. And the implication of this is if you could somehow convince, say, 200 Harvard students to re-enroll in Rose Holman Institute of Technology, because of the characteristics of the curriculum and other aspects of the school, they would probably end up making more money if they went to Rose Holman, even though the typical Harvard graduate earns a little bit more than a typical Rose Holman graduate.
Wow, that's pretty profound. So you're saying there's real value added in terms of where you go?
Yeah, there is. We know from academic research unrelated to this project that qualities of colleges can have very significant impacts on the earnings of alumni. And it's not entirely clear what all the mechanisms are, but a few have been identified. So the one obvious one is the curriculum that the college provides. If it's training people for the most in-demand occupations in computer science and engineering that have very high salaries, chances are that the average graduate's going to do better than the schools that focus more on a typical liberal arts curriculum. But then beyond that, there's also factors like how well the school keeps students on track. Do they have a high retention and graduation rate? And that's something that we found is predictive of value added as well. And there are a number of reasons why schools vary in the graduation rate. Some of it comes down to student support services, the level of financial aid they're providing, and things like that. And we try to consider all those factors.
Yeah, and graduation rates is something that schools are looking at more. It's funny, we're used to talking about that in terms of high school, but it does seem like there's more attention these days on how well schools are, not just accepting kids, but helping them stay.
Well, it's hugely important to their future earnings. People that have only some college but no degree earn substantially less than people who have actually finished their degree. And so the public loses in addition to the individual who loses out on maybe $500 to $1 million in career income. The public loses in terms of tax dollars, and that's a huge problem when we think about all the billions of dollars of subsidies that we give colleges all around the country, including community colleges and four-year schools that are doing a fairly lousy job in terms of keeping their students on track.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned that one of the differences that you would expect, and you mentioned this, Jonathan, is schools that train people for more technical industries like engineering. You know, we hear so much about STEM. They tend to make more than folks who graduate with traditional liberal arts degrees. So you would understand that. Did you also find, though, that let's compare an English major at University A and an English major at University B, and still there's some value added at University B that the student at University A didn't get? It's not just about the degree.
That's right. We did have some findings that shed some light on that. We couldn't directly compare students who majored in the same thing across schools because of data limitations. But we can see that even adjusting for curriculum, there are schools vary quite a bit in how well they prepare their students to earn higher salaries. And we found a handful of liberal arts colleges like Carleton College in Minnesota, St. Mary's College in San Antonio, Texas, Colgate in New York, do very well in terms of value added for their mid-career salaries of their alumni. And it's not attributable to the curriculum, which looks pretty similar to the curriculum of many other colleges. It boils down to what we call an X factor, which is really just aspects of the college that we can't observe, but could be related to the quality of the teaching staff, could be related to the alumni networks. It's not at all clear.
Ah, the X factor. I was going to ask you about that. Okay, so it's hard to measure professor quality, but maybe there's something there. Also, the strength of the alumni networks. That's really interesting, Jonathan. I hadn't thought about that at all. Give us a little more on that, how that might be part of this X factor, this value-added X factor.
Well, sure. I recently read an article, I think it was in the Wall Street Journal, New York Times, where they were trying to explain which graduates from which schools tend to go to top companies. And what the author argued is that a disproportionate number of alum from Duke University's Graduate School of Business, after they get their MBA, they work for Apple in at high rates. And the reason seems to be, according to the author, that Tim Cook is a Duke alum.
Oh my goodness!
So there are hundreds and thousands of those sorts of relationships going on all around the country, where for whatever reason, it's easier to tap into those alumni networks. I know from my own alumni network that I can go to my school's website and look up by occupation, industry, different people, and send them an email. And if I were looking for a new job, that would be a great place to start. And I've gotten emails from students who want to learn more about my career path. So there's definitely something to that.
Again, our number here in the exchange for you to join us for the next couple minutes as we talk to Jonathan Rothwell about this study on value-added college rankings at thousands of colleges and universities across the country. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. We're looking at what might account for the different mid-career salaries from alumni of different schools. 1-800-892-6477 is our number. Email exchange at nhpr.org. A couple more questions for you, Jonathan. President Obama, about a year ago, called for more attention to the quote-unquote value of a college education. I think he suggested a value-based scorecard for colleges and universities. And, of course, we did some programming on that with New Hampshire higher education folks, many of whom were quite upset about this, said, look, you can't just spit various numbers into a machine and have them spit out a ranking. But then here you guys are with the ranking. So I wonder how this fits into what President Obama has been calling for.
Yeah, it overlaps quite a bit, and I'm hopeful that they take this sort of approach, not that they necessarily need to do it exactly how we did it, But I do hope they consider value added in coming up with any sort of rating system, because it's extremely important to adjust for the sorts of students that go to different colleges. There's one sense, though, that I agree with the critics of that approach, and I know from doing this that you can't really boil down a college to one rating. And in fact, we offer three different value-added ratings. But you know, there are just so many data limitations to doing this. For example, we're using pay scale data to measure alumni earnings. That's only a small number, about 1,000 of the 7,000 colleges where pay scale reports data. Not clear how large the sample size is for some of them. Pay scale says the average is around 325 alumni. It would be much better to use federal tax records and get data on all alumni. We're also – one of our outcome measures is repayment rates on student loans. That includes everyone who gets a student loan, but that's a fairly rough measure of economic success. So, you know, the bottom line is it's – I wouldn't tie these sort of ratings, no matter how well you could do them, to any kind of funding formula where if a school does bad, it automatically gets deducted in terms of federal allocations. Rather, I would use this as a starting point. This is what we try to emphasize in the report. To really begin the conversation on how the school might improve. If it looks like the curriculum's great, but the default rates are high, graduation rates are low, then the school needs to really target, you know, those aspects of how it can improve student performance. Conversely, if the curriculum looks really bad and so students aren't coming out with in-demand skills and are just sort of but are still graduating at high rates, then they might think about, you know, offering some other programs that that employers are more interested in.
So you're sort of getting into this, so let's go there, Jonathan. How should prospective college students and their families who are trying to sort this out, how should they use this data?
Yeah, I likewise, I would use it as a starting point. I wouldn't base my entire decision on how well a school does in these on these ratings. There are so many factors one needs to consider, like the location of the school, how much aid they're going to give you, which is almost an idiosyncratic decision based on the unique circumstances of the student. Then there are, you know, there's the issue of what they want to study.
Right.
Just because, you know, MIT and Caltech do, you know, fabulously well here doesn't mean that everyone's going to want to study engineering, computer science. We still need preschool teachers. You know, we still need a whole range of occupations that aren't STEM. So, you know, what we hope here is that they can look at this and compare the schools that they're interested in. Maybe they boil it down to five or six colleges and see, well, the default rate is a bit higher here. You know, the types of occupations people go into in this other school don't pay as well. So, you know, if they're on, sort of on the fence between one or the other, this can be, you know, shed some light and maybe push them one direction or another.
So NHTI, there was a lot of cheering here in New Hampshire and especially in Concord when New Hampshire Technical Institute was put, I think, right at the top of your rankings there. What helped NHTI in particular come out so well in these rankings, Jonathan?
Well, just to be clear, we ranked two-year colleges separately from four-year colleges.
Sure, it's a totally different experience.
At the top.
Yeah,
right. But they did rank at the top of two-year colleges, as you're saying. And really, it's their outcomes are remarkable on all three of the things we measured: salary, repayment rate on loans, and the type of occupations that students enter. And when we look at, you know, what seems to be driving that, it's not really the graduation or re-enrollment rate, which aren't that strong, but it's the school looks fantastic on the skills that alumni list on their resumes. Looks very good on the curriculum, which you'd expect from a technically oriented school. And then there's an unexplained part of this that that we can't really boil down to any specific thing. But what does stand out, I'll just elaborate slightly on the alumni skills thing, because that's a fairly unique measure that hasn't been issued before. We looked at LinkedIn resumes and matched the skills that people list on their LinkedIn resumes to job vacancy postings and the value that salaries list on job vacancy postings. And we found that an HTI alum, have very high skills.
All right. Well, Jonathan, thank you very much for being with us. We appreciate it.
My pleasure.
That's Jonathan Rothwell, fellow with the Metropolitan Policy Program at the Brookings Institution in D.C. He co-authored the new report that we talked about on value-added college rankings, both for 2- and 4-year schools. If you want to check it out, it's on our website, nhpr.org/exchange. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. The senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Faith Mikesell and Jason Moon. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Knoy.